I would like to say that Freedom Club USA is an educational club. We have lots of education available through the website for the public and some for members only. With all of that, we do not give any financial, legal, or tax advice. However, we do have for the members access to speakers who are experts in these areas for you to continue your education in these areas. And this is our Monday night call on June 16, 2008. And I would like to say just a few words before we bring out Tom, our founder. And once again, welcome all of you. I see a lot of new faces on the call tonight who are attending our call for the first time. My name is Joanne. I'm one of the directors of the club, and you will also be hearing from Tom, who is our founder. We are excited to have you learn about new possibilities that you may have never thought possible with our program. Tonight you'll be introduced to Freedom Club USA. We are a one-of-a-kind private membership organization. There is no other organization that is able to offer you the contractually proprietary process that we have, where you are by membership invited. That's a mouthful, but you'll understand what that means shortly. The club is dedicated to our six pillars of freedom. They include asset and financial freedom, energy freedom, personal and health freedom, and benevolence. Hopefully, you have had the opportunity to see our website and sign up for our free newsletter. Our website address is www.freedomclubusa.com. And by going to that web address and signing up for a free newsletter, you get lots of information and access to our website. Please thank the person who invited you to our call to give you our information, because our calls and our membership are by invitation only. So you're a special person who is invited to this call tonight. A few more comments I have in the preceding weeks to our call tonight. It seems like we were working around the clock here at Freedom Club USA. And looking at the economy in the United States, it is no wonder why the club has been incredibly busy. We have been just deluged with new memberships for learning and our proprietary processes. Many thousands of people have been laid off, as we know, across the United States. Inflation has set into our daily living standards, and most people have two or three possibly jobs as the normal right now, trying to stretch their budgets. If it's difficult to maintain a decent living when we try so hard now, what happens when the unknown hits us? And I heard a couple of callers that called in tonight, one from Ohio with the floods, one from Iowa with the floods. And our thoughts and our hearts really go out to you. When we look at the tragedy of the Midwest floods, what some people have even termed the Katrina of the North, and the recent barrage of tornadoes across the country, some questions come up in my mind. Would you survive a catastrophic emotional event like this? And the answer is sure you would, but picking up the pieces to return to everyday life might be measured in years. It's going to take time to pull it all back together. So if on one hand you're stretching your budget in normal life and something of a crisis comes up, wow, it's really, really difficult this time. But the good news is Freedom Club USA is a solution-based organization, and that's what we're here for. We're here for solutions. We're here, how do you put Band-Aids on your budget? What happens when the Band-Aids come off? We have some of those answers tonight. What happens if there's something catastrophic in your life? We do have answers. Tonight you're going to learn how to take back your financial future for you as an individual. But we don't really stop there, because there are hundreds of people in companies that may apply the same principles. We get calls from people who have been in the airlines and manufacturing and financial services, just to name a few. because they're in trouble. And we are helping all of those people through the education that we have and solutions that we have. So whether you are a large organization and you're coming to our call tonight to hear what we have to say, or a head of household, we can help all of you. So the question is, how do we do it? In just a minute, you will learn about how you're able to receive a refund or a settlement from any loans you have engaged in by our proprietary process that no other company has. If you've signed for a bank loan on the dotted line, or a mortgage, or a home equity line of credit, a loan for a car, a student loan, business line of credit, or have a debt note from the IRS that says, we're demanding, with our penalties and interest, you now owe us $53,000, just as an example. We can help get a refund or a settlement that you're entitled to. This is a totally legal process, and if you're not aware of what is due to you, please listen tonight, because our founder, Tom, is going to explain why and how you're entitled to these funds. Most people don't know that they are entitled, and that's why Freedom Club USA is so popular, because word is getting out that we have the secret. So Freedom Club USA is 100% successful in obtaining judgments in your favor. We never ask you to step into a courtroom. The club actually does all the paperwork for you, and we have had brilliant people, and still do, in our club, who have strived for years to attain this goal. We have a fabulous research committee with lots of experts. And because of their brilliance, you are now able to accomplish what the rest of us already know. So without further ado, I'd like to bring out our founder, Tom, and a belated happy Father's Day to the father of Freedom Club USA.
Well, thank you, Joanne, and welcome everyone. So glad to have you here. I'm going to give you a little overview, and I'm going to cover six key areas tonight on this chat. One will be, first, as I say, an overview of who and what we are. Second will be, we're going to talk about commerce. It's very important to understand the commercial side of the world, what it is. Next, we're going to go into the U.S. history and how that plays a very integral role. Then we're going to get into the bankruptcy of the United States, how that happened. Then we're going to go into bank loans. How do banks actually loan money, or do they? And then we're going to talk about winning, the win-win. We don't challenge banks, the win-win process. And lastly, we'll get into and touch on asset protection, because once you have received payoffs, you'll need asset protection. So let's get started. First of all, Freedom Club has been around about a little over 3.5 years. If you're new to our process, as I said, it's a win-win process, quite unique. Nothing like anything you've seen out there or heard. There's many people who try to do one of two things when they try to reclaim dollars spent with the banks. They try to challenge the system. They either try to beat or cheat the system, and they lose, because the system is designed to protect itself. We do neither of those. We'll explain what exactly we do here in the course of this call. Let's start with commerce. The world commerce is driven by admiralty law. Now, admiralty law is not a familiar term to most of us. We may hear today the term UCC, or Uniform Commercial Code. We're a little more familiar with that. Well, its origins are indeed the admiralty. So what does admiralty mean? Sounds like something to do with the seas. So if we go back into the history, we see that the open seas were the way of commerce in the early days of shipping. That was the only way goods traveled any distance from country to country. However, if there's a challenge, let's say some goods were damaged or missing en route, how do you rectify it? We have different laws in different countries. How do you settle it? Whose court do we use? So what was decided, let's create another set of laws for the open seas, for shipping, for commerce. We'll call it the laws of admiralty. So if a shipment from Spain to Australia is lost or damaged, the recipient has the right now to, without going to any court, on simply a letter form, state his claim in simple terms. Send it back to the shipper explaining the loss. The shipper has the option then to agree by doing nothing or to challenge. If he has evidence that what was said in the letter is not correct, he must provide proof. He cannot deny it, but he can provide proof of something different, which then is returned to Australia, or in most cases, they simply ignore it and agree. A second letter goes out from Australia as part of this process just to confirm, to make sure that you're aware we are about to wrap this thing up. If you have a challenge, you better get it to me quick. Nothing again. The third letter goes, and at that point, what is stated in letter one becomes truth. There's no court. There's no dispute. It is the laws of admiralty. So they are now legally able to deduct, if you will, part of that payment for the missing goods in this instance. Now we say, well, that's fine, but what's that got to do with me? Yeah, I live here in America someplace, and I'm not even near the sea. You may be, but you may not be. Well, as the years progressed, they found admiralty law had implications everywhere. And each of the countries also, in our country in particular, said we need to have every state or give every state access to the sea. Well, how can we do that? Well, we have roadways that run up from the sea to every point on this in this country, do we not? Well, those roadways now in the world of admiralty became waterways. In fact, with some of the flooding we heard about earlier, that has become more true than we would imagine. But even when they're dry, they're still considered waterways in admiralty. So every state, no matter how landbound they are, or any place, has access to the sea. So primarily, since World War II, the rules of admiralty have dominated in the form, codified in the form of UCC, now dominate and are, in fact, the rule of the earth. There is one governing body, and that's the Uniform Commercial Code. Now, you might say, well, that's cool for commerce if I'm buying goods and have a dispute, but what about crime? What if somebody steals, breaks into my home and steals something? Well, if they stole something, there's a value. There's commerce. And you say, yeah, that's right. What about murder? Certainly, murder can't be commerce. Indeed, it is. And you'll discover later in our call, when we get into the straw man, how the straw man is the source of funding for everything. Therefore, if you've harmed the straw man, you've harmed funding. Therefore, you've committed a commercial act. It, too, falls under the rules of UCC. Go into a courtroom today, and you will see a flag hanging there. It's not your flag you're used to seeing. It's not your sovereign flag that's 1.9 by 1 in dimension. It's a stubbier flag, a shorter flag, and it has gold fringe. Well, gold fringe is the sign of admiralty, as is the military flag that you'll see flying there. Military also runs under the rules of admiralty. And by the way, the rules of admiralty say you're guilty until proven innocent. A little different than what we hear told to us, isn't it? So if you wonder why it appears that we are not winning in the courtrooms, it's because we've already lost, actually, before we got in the courtrooms. We'll explain that in a moment. But before you leave your courtroom, go up to the back of the courthouse sometime and look for the water pole. Yeah, a water pole. Even on high dry land, you'll see a water pole, and very often on these courthouses, what are they telling you? We are in admiralty law. Okay. You go in the courtroom, you sit in the courtroom, and they'll spew out state law, federal law, whatever. But even the judges today, if you bring up constitutional law, the U.S. Constitution, they're going to say, we don't do that here. They actually are telling people that. And they're right, they don't. I'm not saying right or wrong that they should or shouldn't. I'm just saying they don't, and they're admitting it. So admiralty law is what rules. And the Uniform Commercial Code is, in most cases, we believe, administered by the Secretary of State. Many of us have filed a UCC form. We fill out a piece of paper, or we go online to that state, and we complete what's called a UCC filing. It is not the way we do it. It does not work. First of all, the system that they have created in this commercial world with the banks is a private closed system. It's not for your use. Never was intended for your use. It was intended for their use in filing against you. Now, they'll take your paper. They'll let you do that because they can turn around and process that paper and make money with it. Will you get the filing protection you hope for? No. You'll notice when they make the filing, they give you a copy and they keep the original. If you don't have them control the original in the filing, you've already lost your chances in this whole process we'll be discussing. So that's why we do not file with the Secretary of State. We do it directly with the source. So that's called a GL-UCC filing. So if you hear that term, you'll understand a bit that that's a very unique type of filing only we provide. Let's skip ahead now to a little bit of history. Let's go back, actually, in time. Let's go back to the Civil War of the U.S. We had a split between the North and the South, actually induced by British, by playing a little commercial, there's commerce again, a little commercial game, deciding to move their commerce to the South where it might be cheaper. The North said, oh, no. And so, therefore, the rift began. Slaves were just an incidental part of this, but the point being, when the South separated or withdrew, even when the war ended, Lincoln tried to bring back the Union to unify it, and in his attempt, he had to force, literally force from Atlanta, the Southern representatives to come back. Well, if you force somebody back, that is not a legal contract. Now, they did. And in his attempt, again, to restore the Union, his life was taken. John Wilkes Booth was a friend of the bankers. So banking, as a rule, let's talk about that. What did Lincoln want to do? He wanted to restore the Union and pay the debts of the war with his own money by creating, as the Constitution stated, you can and will create your own money. Okay? You didn't have to borrow it from the king. That ticked off the king. I want you to borrow my money to keep you in debt so I can control you. And Lincoln thought otherwise and said, nope, not going to do that. So his life was taken, and Johnson came in to replace him, and with it came a whole different kind of government that none of us saw or none of us had read about in our history books. The original sovereign constitution we're all familiar with, if you look carefully at the United States in its printing, the United is in lowercase and so is states. But a new version, a copy, was created at that time, the old one put on a shelf. The new one had the capital letters United States, all caps. Now, if you look in Black's Law, you'll see the word United States or any word in caps means it's a corporation. That's their way of saying we are now a corporation. So where did they incorporate? Well, of course, in England. So we have an English company, a corporation called United States, the United States of America, U.S. of A., all the different flavors and variations. We became a corporation. We no longer were the sovereign government. It was still there in principle, but not anybody filling those seats. So now we have a private corporation posing as our sovereign government. So every law passed from that point forward really did not apply to us. It only applied to those who were party to that corporation. So even we the people wasn't us. It's that corporation. Washington, D.C., and the territories of the U.S. and employees of the government. Quite interesting. So that was in 1851. So now we move along to 1910. We're going to move to a place called Jekyll Island. When Andy Jackson took office some years before, he was president, he swore, 75 years before, he swore he would release the U.S. from the control of the central banks, which had permeated the U.S. And he did. There were five attempts on his life, all thwarted. And for 75 years up to 1910, there were no central banks. The U.S. was an up-and-coming threat to the world. No taxation, prosperous, a free society. Well, we can't have that, said the bankers, and we're not making any money on this, so we need to get into this country. So a meeting off the coast of Georgia on a little island at a major hotel there, I've been interested in the very room where they created what's today called the Federal Reserve System. These are private bankers. Some of them happen to be congressmen there, but on private business, supporting the takeover of the U.S. by the banks. This is their plan. They did it under extreme secrecy. You can listen to the preacher from Jekyll Island, the audio, or read the book by Ed Griffin, Fabulous Awakening, and you realize how ruthless they were in their attempts to and do whatever it took to get this law passed. It did pass, indeed, in 1913 under Woodrow Wilson, who was put into presidency for that reason by the bankers. They funded him and put him in that position. In fact, on his deathbed, he said, "I have disgraced my own country." He realized the horror he did by approving the Federal Reserve Act. But indeed, it went into effect in 1913, and in just 20 years, we took a very prosperous, virtually debt-free country and brought it to its knees in bankruptcy. We have the Roaring Twenties. Remember those? Loose credit, easy money. Well, what were people doing before they had all this bank money? They saved their money. Banks, or people did, businesses did. They saved their money, and they used that to expand and grow. Well, banks made money so cheap and easy that they said, well, gosh, you can grow faster. You can invest in all kinds of ways. And so they, if you will, poisoned the water in that respect, and people started borrowing money, individuals, businesses. And we have this huge burst of growth. We've seen it recently in our own country, haven't we, in recent years. Pump a lot of money into the economy, and a lot of things happen. Well, what happened in 1929? We heard about the great stock market crash. Well, that was induced. That was planned, manipulated, exactly as planned. And indeed, a few rich people lost some money. But did that create the Depression? No, not really, not at all. That was just a ruse to set up stage two, was FDR coming in, and they wanted to wait till 1933 for the election to complete, so he would be there, their inside man, to continue the next phase. How did the Depression happen then? If you pump a lot of money into the economy and make easy credit available, it expands. What happens if you suddenly say, well, when you come in for your weekly loan to buy your inventory, to expand your business or just to maintain it, the banker says, sorry, money's tight. Can't give you a loan this week, Joe. So Joe goes back and realizes, well, I can't buy these goods. I can't sell these goods. I'm going to lay off a few people. And now they're out of the street. They haven't got money to spend. And we have a very rapid downturn. And in fact, exactly what happened. The money supply was withdrawn. 50% of the money was drawn out of the entire economy from 1929 to 1933. That is a depression, folks. So we had willing workers, willing merchants, willing buyers, but no money. That was it. Just control the money, as Rothschild said. I care not what laws you passed. As long as I can control the money, I have all I need. So indeed, that continued until FDR was brought into office with his New Deal, or we call the Raw Deal. The country, now at this point, was bankrupt as well, because if revenues are down, taxes are down, the few that there were, and thus we couldn't make our payments, because guess what? Who else was borrowing money? The government. We had a World War I to pay for, which was also manipulated and controlled by the same powers in the world. To have a war, run up expenses, put people into bankruptcy, why? Why? The U.S. was just one more casualty around the world, one of the later ones. Why do they want us in bankruptcy? Well, if the banks have loaned the country money and they can't pay, if you've ever been in bankruptcy court, you'll know who's in control. It isn't you. It isn't the borrower. It is the lender, and the courts are there to enforce it. So we have the courts now enforcing and giving control to the banks. So the U.S. is still today in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. In that bankruptcy, your debtor in possession, meaning you get to keep your toys and play with them, but you got to make payments as we dictate. And how was that? Well, we call it the IRS. We're going to make sure you pay back your debt, because we're going to pull it out of the paychecks and out of the labor of the people of this country. As much concern was indeed the 16th Amendment ratified, whether it was or wasn't, here's the IRS in full force and full-fledged power today, taking our money. Money goes back, not 1 cent, by the way, of that money goes back to our government. It all goes back to pay the debt that's been created. And part of that even goes to the Vatican, 5%. So we have now this country in bankruptcy. Our next topic is going to be on bank loans. How do banks actually create loans? If, in fact, they did loan money to you or I or the country, and we can't manage our money well or don't do well, perhaps we say we should pay them back. We should be honoring our obligations. So let's take a look and see if banks indeed do what we think they do or not. When you or I walk into a bank today, we see a sign, an advertisement that says we loan money. And we also give you credit cards. So they're essentially saying we loan our money and we loan our credit. That would appear. But if you check the charter of that bank, or any bank, you will find, by law, they cannot loan their own money, they cannot loan their depositors' money. So what is their role? Their role is to accept, store, and return to you your deposits on your demand, unless it's a time deposit, and at the time of that time expansion. Nowhere does it allow them to loan their credit or their own money. So how do they do it? There's only three people involved here. You've got other depositors, can't touch their money. You've got the bank, can't touch theirs, and we have you. So there's only one party left that could possibly fund that loan, and that's you. But you say, wait a minute, I'm the one who needs the money. I'm walking into the bank. Well, stop a minute. We covered a moment ago that the country is bankrupt. What happened in 1933 was they removed all money from all of us. Remember the great gold heist in 1933 after the bankruptcy? So if all gold was returned, even though it was an executive order and only applied to federal citizens, not to the state citizens or state people or the sovereign people. But the implication was there, if you didn't do it, you would go to jail and pay a huge fine. So the people capitulated and felt honor at the time that to save the country, they would turn in their gold, and they got a gold receipt. Piece of paper. Gold for paper. And years later, it was gold, or that paper, converted into silver certificates. Said, well, we won't pay you in gold, we'll pay you in silver. In 1971, Nixon said, no, we're going to drop that totally, and we're going to back this by nothing. And then we saw inflation rates jump to over 20% immediately. So we went off a solid backing. What is backing a dollar today, then, and what did since 1933? And what backs those dollars, we call them dollars, that really, since we're bankrupt, there is no money. These are credits. Look at the term Federal Reserve Note on your bills. A note is a promise to pay. It's just an IOU. That's all it is. It has no value intrinsically. It's backed, in fact, by you, the individual. And you're saying, how did that happen? Well, 1933, when we went into the bankruptcy, there has to be some way to function, so we create little credits or IOUs. Well, what backs it were the birth certificates of the people. And at that point, a straw man was being created. A straw man is your name in all caps. Remember earlier we said the United States? We knew it was a corporation because it was all capital letters. The same is true here, when your name, John Jones, is all caps, it says that part of you or that fiction of you is a corporation. You are also the flesh and blood, upper lowercase, John Jones. So you're two things. You're the flesh and blood, and you're the corporation. It's a fiction. Okay, all corporations are fictions. So they made a fiction of you because, again, what happened? The U.S. became a corporation in 1871. The states followed, by the way, so all the states went through the same process. They went bankrupt, and so the states all are corporations in bankruptcy. But here's something odd. If you look at each state, you'll see state of Michigan, Michigan State. State of Florida, Florida State. New York State, state of New York, and so forth. Everyone has those two versions, and we always kind of thought, well, it's odd, but didn't think much of it. One is the corporation. One is the original sovereign state before 1871 or whenever they went bankrupt, if they came in later. So that is the mirror. What happened in Washington has happened elsewhere as well. So right now we have, just to review, a foreign country, a British corporation, posing as our sovereign government, okay, a private, for-profit organization that has a bill collector called the IRS that is posing as your government for the people. Well, what people? For their corporation. That's who the people are. So how did they link you two together? One, they created this straw man of you, the corporation, because a corporation can only deal with another corporation, so therefore, okay, we got that figured out, so look at your birth certificates, all capital letters. Those capital letters tell us, again, you're a corporation. Look at your driver's license. It's always caps. Look at any invitation to court. Look at any business license you've ever gotten. They're always in capital letters. So they're saying, we're treating you as a corporation. Look at your check on your checkbook. It's always in caps. When you sign, you're signing now as the surety or the one who will guarantee the corporation's funds. So you're not the corporation itself. You're the surety of it as the upper lowercase, really taking responsibility for your upper caps. If you want to frustrate a judge sometimes, just walk into a courtroom when you have a case come up and you'll ask for John Jones. And you stand up and say, I'm here, the upper lowercase John Jones, representing the all capital letters John Jones. Wow, you want to see some smoke come out of their ears. I've done this, and they don't know what to do. And they play a game after game after game trying to get you to admit you are the surety for the uppercase. And if you don't do it, they won't do anything. They can't. I'm not saying this is a way to resolve court issues. I'm just saying that's a fact that they will find other ways. But the point here is they do know the distinction, folks. This is not made up. This is for real. So back to our bank loan. So now we have a little history. So now we have a straw man account, and we have these credits that are created. So there's an infinite amount of credits available in every straw man's account, because in potential, any person being born has the ability in a lifetime to do what? Earn lots and lots of these credits. So there's no limit. Now, a funny thing happened, though, right after your birth. You had the birth, and then you had your cord snapped, your umbilical, and you died, according to them. And a death certificate is issued on your straw man. Now, when there's no will, obviously there was not time to create one, the state becomes the processor of your will, the Secretary of State. So they are the keeper, if you will, of this fund, the straw man credit fund, okay, that follows you your whole life. So when you go to the bank now and are borrowing, it's really that fund is where the monies are coming from. Here's how it works. You sit down with this nice loan officer and you say, I'd like this home, need $200,000, thank you. And you fill out a form, and it's a nice promissory note. And it says, gosh, I'm going to pay you, Mr. Banker, $200,000 over 30 years at this percent interest rate, and I sign it. The bank didn't sign it. Looks just like a check, doesn't it? Isn't that the way we write checks? It's a promise to pay, a promissory note, and that's what it is. So he takes the note when you leave, turns it over, stamps it, pay to the order of the bank, and sends it off to the Fed. The Fed is not federal, as we learned. It's not, has no reserves. It is a system of 12 banks or 12 processing centers, which really are just one, split into 12 parts. It goes to the nearest one, and what do? They simply, on their computers, tap into that straw man account created at your birth and pull out $200,000. That is wired over to your local bank into an account in your name. Remember, that's your money. What does the bank do at closing? They call you back, Mr. Jones, you're all approved, everything's ready, let's come on in, let's get this done. So you show up, and what do? They write a check off of your account. Now, that doesn't sound quite proper, but they bring it to the closing, and it gives the illusion that they funded the loan. Quite a smoke and mirrors trick. And you're happy as can be. You got your home, and you got your bill. Now, something else before you leave the branch is you've been given another set of documents to sign. And those are actually, if it's a home, documents to take away what was just given to you. Because at that moment, it was your money that paid for the home. That home was yours at that instant, free and clear. In bankruptcy, that's how it works. Now, unfortunately, what was given, they took away. They put some more papers under your pen, and you signed away that you are now becoming a renter in that home. A renter. Read the fine print. You'll see it in there. What that in gives them power to do is to evict you should you ever fail to make your payments. See, they cannot evict a homeowner, only a renter. The laws protect the owner. So they make sure you're a renter so they can foreclose. So now you go home, and you're happy, you get your first bill, and you pay it, and your second, and maybe your 10th and 100th, and then eventually one day you get into trouble, or you just come to a call like this, and you learn, I actually don't owe that bank anything, because they didn't loan me anything. I funded my own loan with my money. What am I doing here? So now the light bulb goes off, and you realize every dollar you've spent on principal, interest, and late payments on that house, the prior house you sold, and one before that, and all the cars, and the student loans, and the credit cards, you can reclaim every dollar, plus penalties. Now, the penalties for this process are significant, and In the banking industry, there's a special name. When somebody demands money from you that is not owed, it's called conversion. So the process is completed in a methodology I'll call Admiralty. Remember that? We've said it's a paper process. It's about a 3-week process. We start the process for you with a little information that you provide about your bank. A note or letter goes out to the bank. They do not respond in almost every case. If they do, it's not a relevant response, we have found. The second letter goes out a short time later, and finally the third. If not responded, we now indicate the account or the process is closed. There's no more money we're demanding. We've closed the account because we're going to collect it a different way. We never do expect the banks to pay, and they wouldn't have the money to pay anyway. But we have to go through the procedure as outlined in the Uniform Commercial Code in bankruptcy for this admiralty process. This process should be looking very familiar because it happened to you, many of you, when you're late on payments. What do? They send you a late notice. That's step one in the laws of admiralty, remember? The shippers sent a notice saying there's some challenges here, and here's what we demand. They're demanding their payment. Well, then you don't do anything, so they send you letter two. What happens now? You still don't have the money to pay them, or you might call them and do a few things, but you haven't responded to the rules of admiralty. You haven't followed the rules of a proper response. So letter three comes, and the deal's over, folks. They just won. The laws of admiralty have been utilized against you. The third letter, they've won. They've won their judgment. They have it. It's over. Whether it was a car, a home, a credit card, doesn't matter. They've gotten their judgment. Now, when we use the process, it works exactly the same. After the third letter to them, you have won just as readily and easily. Now, what they do with their process is they'll drag you into court. They'll garnish wages. They'll do all kinds of things. You get to court and think, well, I'll beat them in court. I got all the truth, the facts on my side. You guys didn't loan me money, or, you know, poor me, or, you cry on the court's shoulder. Whatever strategy you use, you walk away with your head in your hands. Okay, the bank wins. Why? We'll take a look at the structure. What is bankruptcy all about? And who rules for the bank? We say the judge rules from the bench. Look up bench in Latin, and you'll see that means bank. The judges rule for the bank. They will. They will support the bankruptcy of the United States, of which the banks are the secured party. Always. They will not go against that. Whether it's the U.S. or personal, it's all the same banking system. So, you walk away defeated, thinking, well, if I was a little smarter, I perhaps could have won. The case was won before you got to court. Court was there just to put it on the record and make you think you had your day in court, make it look legitimate. It was already completed in admiralty before you entered the courtroom. So just understand that. So that's how powerful admiralty is. They'll deny very often the banks that admiralty even exists, or the UCC, but they won't, but they'll use it on you every day. So now we have our judgment against the bank. How do we collect? Well, that is the proprietary part of this process that is quite complex, and there's many steps. I mentioned it in an easy way earlier, how the Federal Reserve goes to that account and claims the money, but there's about 50 to 75 steps that are really happening at electronic speed for that to happen. Those same steps are replicated on our end. We don't expect the banks to pay. We create money the same way all money is created at the moment a debt is created. The debt is the debt you just created with your judgment. This multi-million-dollar judgment is the debt. We create money. just as they do, pay you your percent for your contract with us. That money also is tax prepaid. Okay, there is no tax due on that. Just as when a bank loans money, they're doing the same thing. It comes to you as it's not taxable money, is it? Nor is it taxable to the bank. So that is the process of how, in a quick way at least, how money is created. Somebody said recently, if we paid off every debt in the country, there would be no money left, which is true. There would be nothing left because all money is created by debt. Let's move on to the win-win. In this process, we have seen people try to beat the system or cheat the system. Every one of them fail over time in one way or another. And it's not honorable to try to beat or cheat someone. The system is designed to protect itself. They have the courts there to protect them, the attorneys to protect them, the government to protect them. Why do you think you are smarter than they are? They've been at this a very long time and perfected it. And why would you try when you can work with them? So we've taken the path of least resistance and actually understand their business. As we understood, they're a corporation for profit. They understand, just like the Federal Reserve understands money, so does the Treasury and the IRS. So if we have contracts, as we do with them, and show them how to win while we win, everybody wins. And that's how we do it, folks. Exactly what I said. The last step I'll cover tonight is asset protection. Once you have been funded a large sum of money, you will want to protect it. That's why one of the reasons we minimize the dollar amounts on this call, because we don't want to make anyone a target, certainly. And we want to show you legal, ethical ways to secure and protect your wealth. And we have many of those. Once you're a member, you can listen to, oh gosh, dozens and dozens of tape calls from experts we brought in on various topics of asset protection, structuring, both onshore and offshore. This is how the rich and famous have done it for years. So that's all part of the process. So let's talk for a minute, what is the process? When we get started, the first step is the newsletter. There's a little place on the site in the upper right corner, which has about, a dozen, 14 steps in order that will guide you from beginning to end to get your education complete. This call will certainly help, but it's only a start. Signing up for the newsletter is step one. Very simple thing, because if you're not on a newsletter list, we can't assign you a consultant. You'll be asked to choose. When you have a consultant, now you have somebody to handhold you through the process. Okay, your go-to person. The other steps are logical steps, but somewhere down the line, you'll see it's time to perhaps secure a membership if you choose. No one's going to ask you to do anything. We're here to support you, help you, answer questions, but it's your choice to become a member or not at $300. Okay, if you choose, you can. There's a study guide to check your learning as you go. There's two of them, one before you're a member, one after you're a member. And then somewhere along the way, you might say, I'd like to do a process, an AR, an administrative remedy, against one of those loans, or maybe two, or five, or ten, or all of them. They all have a cost. On average, they're $2,700 apiece. There's a straw man fee to do that GO filing we spoke of earlier, and that is $300. That's one time for each person that wants to get involved. And that's basically it. The rest of the costs, they're all laid out on the site if you want to peruse them, by all means. Or talk to your consultants on your own. So it's not a difficult thing at all from your standpoint. We've done the hard work. So if you're ready to go forward and make, you know, whatever step you're on, go to that next step, absolutely. We're here to help you.